The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Taking care of all the help you need for healthy, glowing skin at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or ray at rte.ie for emails. Now, every Friday we invite somebody into Studio 10 and ask them to guide us through the soundtrack to their lives. And today it's the turn of Brendan Courtney. The reason I skipped over my words there is broadcaster.
Everything.
Activist. Fashion person. What? You know,
if people ask me what do I do, I suppose because I use social media a lot, I say broadcaster and fashion designer.
Right,
two
okay.
things I feel I would do the most. But advocate when it's appropriate and when I feel the energy to use my voice if I'm in the right situation, I suppose. But look, the average person has six careers in their lifetime, so let's...
Is that what they're saying now?
That's what they're saying now, yeah. Everybody's a model or a DJ actor, you know, everybody's a, you know, so I think it's okay to label yourself. You know, I don't want to be labelled, Ray. Basically, I'm a freelance for hire. That's what I am.
Right.
Yeah.
But broadcasting and fashion designing
that's
are...
That's it. That yeah. seems to be what I've been doing for the last 20 years anyway. Yeah.
Okay. Right. That's the lift there, Jamie the King's lift. We didn't mention that Jamie the King is in a wheelchair.
Oh, you didn't?
There you go. It's the, yeah.
Those boys, that just made my year. Yeah. Just incredible, incredible. And next of all, the director of Take Me to Church is sitting there. How cool was that? Like, yeah. Everybody in the producer's block were like, oh my God, that's the guy.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
How talented were those kids? I actually was just in the canteen and all their mums were there and they had the radio alive.
Oh,
and
then
phone,
oh,
and I was
yeah.
like, are they your kids? Yeah, so very, very cute.
Okay, let's go back to your childhood then. You were born to Nuala and Frank in 1971 and you were born in the Coombe.
That's right, Coombe Hospital.
Yes.
In 1970, the year it opened.
Yeah, not just on the side of the road.
No, the Coombe. Anybody, Dublin people just say the Coombe. People
yeah,
go, well, it was the hospital.
But people in Kildare just say the Coombe as well.
Yeah,
so,
exactly, yeah.
But you lived locally. Your family lived locally-ish?
Well, no, my family originally, my grandparents are from Dublin 8. My grandfather's from Ben Borb Street, which is like Stony Batter. And my grandmother is from Inchicore. And then they moved up a little further up to Inchicore, and that's where my mother's from. But my dad's from Crumlin. So right. My grandparents and my dad kind of inner city, West Dublin. So, yeah. Uh-huh.
And how did Nuala and Frank meet?
It's funny you say ask that question, because somebody asked me that recently, and because it's such a family story, and I've obviously never been there, but it's a dance hall called the McCushla. And this woman said, oh, I know that place. My parents met there. And it was the dance hall in the 50s and 60s in Dublin, and all the show bands played there. So my mother was there when she was 15 and my dad was 17, and he asked her to dance, and the rest is history. And here I am.
So they were together all that time?
All that time. Yeah, my mother always says, I'll go to the boring side of heaven. Yeah, they were together.
Right.
Yeah. They were together since they were 15 years of age, yeah. And they met in the McCushla, and we got told that all the time. And
right.
He cycled her home and pretended he lived nearer than he did. He lived in Crumlin. And he cycled her home in the rain, and all very romantic, very romantic, right. Yeah.
And when did they tie the knot, do you know?
They got married in the... It's still there, actually, and just... after Dad passed away, I wanted to spend Christmas there, and it doesn't open at Christmas, unfortunately, but it's gorgeous. Had a refurb. It's the hotel across the road from Connolly Station. Lots of people will know it. It was called the International. They got married there. I think my mom was 20, just about to turn 21, and Dad was 23.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Right.
So they had a long courtship in terms of
yeah. But
my mother was a career woman.
But she was 15 when they met. So
yeah.
It wouldn't have been legal for a few years.
Well, you know what, my mother tells the story, and I'm not speaking out of turn, that she was a little bit wild, and my grandmother loved my father. He was really solid, and my grandmother was like, right, he's the one. He's great. This guy is. He was an apprentice in the gas company, so he had potential and future. And my grandmother was desperate to get them married quickly. And actually, as my mother always says, at the time, they were really in love, and they would go on weekends away. And my dad would insist that they slept in separate bedrooms because they'd been warned. And my mother would be like, you know, she's 18 or 19, and so they, you know, he stayed very honourable and true. And so they got married very, you know, they decided it was time to get married quickly. Because my grandmother was saying, time to get married quickly.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
So the family then, how many siblings do you have?
So lots of people know this because of those two documentaries. But yeah, I have a younger brother, Daniel, who was born when I was 16. And that makes him 32 now. And then Suzanne is the eldest, and Deborah. Suzanne's 5 years older than me, and Deborah's just a year and a half older than me.
Right, so that's a big gap, isn't it, between you and your younger?
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. My mother just always say, he was the only one I actually wanted. Which is not literally, you know, but yeah. We were born in the 70s, so yeah, it was a different time.
What's your first living memory?
My first living memory is being chased by a gaggle of geese through a campsite in Corp Town. And I screaming, and I think I was about 2.5 or 3, and it was terrifying. And I kind of do actually, and it's, but you know, with memories, they get told so often through the family. I remember one time my sister goes, no, I think that was me, and then my mum going, no, it was Brendan,
right?
And there was
scary,
we could tell by the screams it was Brendan,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Yes, yeah, they just turned on me and came running after me. And I'm fine, but it was a big, funny story in our family for years. That's my first memory.
And you were the youngest for a long time, for 16 years.
I actually moved out of home that year, not in protest. I moved to London for the summer. Yeah. Maybe a little bit of teenage protest. Yeah, yeah. What's that? A baby? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm the baby of the family. Yeah, How dare you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. My sister, elder sister, was in London, and as we all did, I went to London for the summer. Yeah.
All right. So were you spoiled?
We were all spoiled. Yeah, my parents, Christmas was insane, ridiculous. Christmas was just over the top every year. They would, anything you asked for, you got. And that was in the 80s, you know, when that kind of wasn't the normal way. And they absolutely loved Christmas. It's Christmas is just still, every smell, every moment of Christmas is just joyous to me. And then Christmas Day was always rather boring. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the anticipation.
You just went out on your bike or whatever you got. Yeah. But my parents put such effort into Santa. I mean, ridiculous clues and hints. And my mother would spend the entire month of December, and my sister does it too, winding us up to fever pitch about Santa. I mean, it was so exciting. And yeah. Santa would come in the middle of the night on Christmas Eve, and we would get a sight of him. Like, it was unbelievable how brilliant they were about Christmas. Yeah, it was amazing.
Were you outgoing as a child?
Ferociously outgoing, yeah. I mean, they're great people. I'm from really nice young parents. They were young. And I remember meeting a friend's mother sometime years later and going, oh, your parents were always the hip young couple that would come to the parents' teacher meeting. So my parents had us very young. And I came from this sort of vivacious, my mother's very outgoing, obviously my dad was very confident, and so I would sort of sing and dance into every room. And yeah, I was kind of, I remember in the summer project in Kingswood, where I'm from, in Talla, in 1981 maybe, so that would make me 10.
Yeah.
And sort of looking around, there was kids doing art in one room, you know, in the school in the summer project, and then you'd all go off for day trips. And I saw there was a dance troupe being set up for the talent show, and I went and I was like, I'd like to act the dance troupe. And they were like, no, you're a boy, you can't. And I was like, oh yeah, I can. You're no good and you're no good. I'm totally joining. So I went home sort of going, I can't join the dance troupe. And my mother was like, yes, you can. So we went across and I was the only boy in a little white suit in the dance troupe. Right. Yeah, so that was pretty confident, right?
Yeah.
I didn't see anything wrong with that.
And ahead of its time.
A little bit. Just
ahead of its time, yeah.
Dad started looking through his fingers going, you go for it, son. Right behind you. Yeah.
And you saw absolutely nothing out of the ordinary with that.
No. It happened in school as well. In secondary school, I was being forced to do woodwork and I wanted to do art, and it was, you know, different times, but the art class was full. And I was like, look at me. I was clearly a kid that should do art, not woodwork. And then I said, okay, I'll do home economics. And they were like, no, you really can't do that. That's really for girls. And I remember my mother going up, and I got in for 6 months to home economics and did knitting.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, let's play a few clips then. Now, we have the Gayborn theme.
Yes, that.
Well, we just
that and the smell of warm Weetabix reminds me of my childhood.
Oh, you were Weetabix and warm milk.
Warm milk. Is that weird?
No.
Still love that.
No, I think a lot of people did it. A lot of people did it. Very mushy.
I love it. And actually, with oat milk, it's totally vegan. It's actually really, it is totally vegetarian, vegan, everything, and it's really good for you. I love it. But that, we used to get that every morning, warm milk and Weetabix. Not porridge, we didn't really like that when we were kids because it was always made on water, but it was made with milk, so it was kind of richer and loads of sugar. And we were off sick. It always reminds me of being really young. My grandmother would come around to our house, or we'd go to my grandmother's house, and the Gayborn hour would always be on. And that music always reminded me of my sisters being at school or me being off sick. Because I only heard that when there weren't other people in the house, because that's when the radio went on. So that just takes me right back to smell of warm Weetabix, you know, my mother cleaning or making, preparing food or whatever.
We should do this actually, just because that comes up so many times.
Does it?
In the soundtrack.
Does it?
So many times. Oh. And I think we should do some sort of a list of the most evocative sounds in this country.
It was really, because actually the questions I was asked to do the interview was, think of, you know, outside the box, don't think of just music. And it was that, and you know, I was thinking it was the noise of the bus after school and stuff like that, because we used to take two buses to school in secondary school from Tala right the way across town. But that was depressing sound. This was a happy sound.
Yeah, yeah. And it still jumps off the radio, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah.
I think because it's so ingrained in us. It's in our DNA, you know.
Mm. Now, so that was the radio. TV. Ah, memories, memories, memories.
I love it.
You can sing along if you like, Brendan. Here we go.
Sunny days. I can't remember now. Oh, I loved it. And it seemed to be on all the time.
Sesame Street, yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was on 24 hours a day. Right?
Would you have a favourite character?
I loved the Grouch. The guy that lived in the bin, wasn't he? I loved him.
Mm.
And then a bit, I loved Mr. Snuffleupagus, who was the invisible friend. And he was huge.
Yeah.
Nobody can see him. It's so good. And he was Big Bird's best friend. So Mr. Snuffleupagus, I love, because remember the human characters would go, who are you talking about? And Mr. Snuffleupagus would just disappear.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember all of that so vividly. I loved it. Yeah.
It started in November of 1969 and it's still running.
Is it still going?
Yeah, it's still going in various different guises, yeah.
Wow.
There was one in Irish recently.
Do you know, I actually do know about it. I don't know how I know about this, but it was actually devised by the Public Broadcasting Service of the US for children who couldn't go to school. So it was for homeschooling. So that's why the count was teaching one, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That was to educate children who weren't actually getting a proper education. So it was designed to be an educational program.
And of course, out of Sesame Street and the Jim Henson workshop came this.
Sunday nights. So for a short period of time, I thought the Muppets were real. My dad one night when I was about 6 or 7 said, you know, they're all real. And I don't know if he was playing, well, I was obviously playing with me. I was like, no way. And he's like, yeah, they're all real. They're from outer space. And they came down and so they just all lived together in a big theater. And I believed it for about 2 months.
Yeah.
I totally believed it. And I had a collection of Muppets. I had, I had from Sesame Street, I had Bert and Ernie. And then I got really into puppetry actually as a kid. And I had a collection of string puppets.
Yeah.
And then I remember going to the Lambert Puppet Theatre and just being blown away, seeing Wanderly Wagon for live. And what was his name? The guy?
Eugene Lambert,
just being bigger than life character, and got really into puppets, and then had a Kermit the Frog, had a Miss Piggy, had the whole, I mean, I remember Star Wars was out and we went shopping because after Christmas and there was the sales on and we were all out, imagine we had the post-sale shopping day as well. My parents were so good. And my dad was like, look at Star Wars. And I was like, I really just want a Miss Piggy. to go with my Kermit so I could do the show.
So that was you from day one.
Putting on shows. Yeah.
Yeah, as far back as you can remember. Yeah. So you mentioned earlier on about then coming into secondary school.
Yes.
And there was a big shift then in your life.
Yeah.
Primary school was
really idyllic.
Yeah.
So I went to St. Killian's in Kingswood in Tala, where subsequently my younger brother went to, and then my two nephews went there as well. And it's mixed and it's really modern and progressive. And they just built Ireland's biggest secondary school beside it now. And I was looking at all the kids, happy, it's mixed school as well. It's really progressive, lovely school. So we went to that primary school. And in fact, my older sister was in the same class as me because it was such a small school.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, the classes.
It was like a country school in Dublin. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like first and second in the same class, second and third. And so I had my big sister always there with me. And even though we pretended we didn't know each other, you know, but we, great support. And then my parents in their wisdom, and remember they were only in their 30s, decided we should go to all Irish speaking schools to get a good job in RTE, as my mother used to say, funny enough. And my mother really wanted me to be a priest, actually. I think she could see I was a little bit different. Or doctor was the other one, which I wouldn't have minded. But we were sent to all Irish schools. Deborah and Suzanne were sent to School Katrina, which is still there in Glasnevin. It's all Irish speaking school. And they had a great time. But I was sent to Cloisteachrane, which is closed down now, which is in Parnell Square.
All boys.
All boys, English speaking, Irish speaking, fully Irish. And if you were caught speaking English, you were beaten.
Right.
It was really quite jockey when I look back now. And I was 11 when I went. I was very young.
You were young.
So
yeah.
Three. You were allowed to do that then. And so I would take a bus on my own with my sister as far as the Keys. And then I'd get my own bus up to Parnell Square at 11, when you think of it. And in I'd go to school. And for about 2.5 years, it was grand at first. And I had a little friend, Ronan, and we would do our little thing and pop around. But I used to have to go home and do my homework with an Irish English dictionary because I had never been to the Gaeltacht. My two sisters had. So I had to learn Irish really quickly, and it was very hard. But then I was really, really badly bullied at that time because I was one of those little gay kids who couldn't hide it. I was very fey little gay. And it just was obvious that I was just different, and that difference stood out to people. But I think bullies would be bullies irrespective of it. But the good side of the story is, by third year, I was like, I'd had enough. So, and I can't blame anybody because I kept it to myself, because that's what you do when you're a kid and you're not dealing with it. So I just left the school and didn't tell anybody. I didn't go back.
Right.
For about 3 weeks.
It must have been bad then.
It was torturous. I mean, And
was it physical or
everything?
Everything.
Three particular guys who I hope get to see me on television all the time make me very happy. They were kids as well. And yeah. I think there's a whole other conversation to be had around that. And I'm not scarred by it. I'm very strong from it. So I don't ever talk about looking for sympathy or anything like that. But you know, that's kind of what happened to fey kids in school at that time.
To fey kids?
Fey. A little bit camp.
Oh, right.
A little bit different in boys' schools.
I'm not familiar with that word.
How do you
spell it?
F-A-Y-E, fey.
Oh, right.
Fey.
right.
Yeah, a little. I think it's quite an onomatopoeia, is it? Fey. It's, yes. It's just short for gay, basically. But I was different. I was a camp little
yes,
kid, and
yeah.
I was always singing, and I had blonde hair, and you know, when I was a kid, when we would be in the playground, my sister would be with me, my defender, Deborah, and they would say, is that a boy or a girl, about me? Because I was just a little bit light in my loafers. I was just one of those little kids. And it made me a target, I guess.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I solved it myself, left, didn't go back.
Didn't tell anybody?
Didn't tell anybody.
Where did you go when you were supposed to be in
fields,
school?
The castle, we had a mobile home at the side of the house. I just went. I just said, I'm not going back there. And I always, you know, in retrospect, looking at that, I had the confidence to do that, to go, right, they're wrong, they're mad, I'm not going back there. And then my parents found out and went straight to the school, and I was taken, airlifted out of the school, and then sent, then it was summertime actually, and then I was sent to Moyle Park College, which I had a brilliant time in Clondalkin. Absolutely brilliant. Turned up with bleached blonde hair and a red leather jacket.
But you were a bit older.
I was a bit older.
More confident.
Yeah. And experienced.
And were they more accepting, the school in general, or...?
I don't know what it was. I slightly reinvented myself with how I looked, and I remember coming through it and having great, you know, backup at home, and constant reassured it wasn't me, it was them, and you know, blah blah blah. I came through it stronger anyway, and I don't know what happened, but from 14 and a half, 15, when I arrived at Moyle Park, I just strutted into that school, and I hung out with the bad boys, and I smoked behind the sheds, and I just was. I had a good time, and I met one of the lads who's now married with 4 kids, really nice guy actually, who's real dub, and how you doing? You were always real arty. And I loved that. Arty was the one I was going for. With the dots. But I was friends with everyone then in that school. It was me, yeah.
And sort of, you know, teenage years can be difficult.
Yeah,
they are difficult. And then when you're sort of negotiating that and navigating through who you are and your sexuality.
Yeah.
And was that...
That's really hard, yeah. Especially when the whole world is telling you it's wrong. And the only person who's telling you it's okay is your parents, really. Who go, doesn't matter who you are, you're fine. You
so it's in the 80s?
It's like 86 I did my intercert, whatever they call it now. And 88 I did my leaving cert. And I was only 16 when I did my leaving cert. And I didn't come out till I was 19.
Right.
So I went to college and had a girlfriend and did all the things my friends were doing, and always knew I was a little bit different. But, you know, I suppose that's why I was so involved in the marriage equality referendum. And shockingly, I'm never say never, but marriage has never been something I've ever really been interested in, but I want the right to choose. But actually what I really thought was, as long as we have equal rights in school, teachers can, you know, when the law defends equality, the bullies can come and go, but the society's on your side.
Yes.
And that was what was important. Yeah. That's the only thing that was important to me, having someone who'd come through when society was really against you. And when teachers would turn their eyes away because they quite didn't know how to handle it because it was obviously you were different. So, yeah, I mean, everything's changed now. And the point about fighting for rights is to not look back, to look forward. And I've always, you know, maintained that stance.
So discos. Did you go to discos?
Of course I did.
Yeah.
So We started going to The Rock in Moyler, and it was on every 3 weeks, and The Rock defined our lives. That was two, I can't wear that. I wore that 3 rocks ago, you know, it was like literally. And there was the Mods and the Rockers. I swear to God, we were like 14. It was, you could only go inter-cert and up. And it was probably 800 kids in the school hall. I mean, when I think of the madness of it, and of course the 15 and 16 year olds are experimenting with drink and whatever you have. And so it was brilliant time though. I mean, they'd play all these, they'd play Depeche Mode and Bronski Beat, and then they'd stop and they'd play Rock, and we'd all sit down.
Oh, yeah.
Play Rock, and then they play our songs. And then there was one song that they would play that would unite everyone.
Which was that?
Depeche Mode.
This one?
Yeah.
All right.
And everybody would.
Mods and Rockers all together on the dance floor.
Dance.
Yeah.
I just can't get
enough. I just can't get enough. All the things you do to me and everything you
said. I just can't get enough. I just can't get enough. I never got what that was about until like 3 years ago. I thought it was about dancing. I just can't get enough of the night that's in it, which is what everybody, I think, was taken from it. Or maybe that was just...
And what was it about?
I think it was about just can't get enough of you and whatever
yes,
that connotation
because
that is.
Because like I would DJ the teenage discos over the years.
Of course, yeah.
And they used to chant in some places down the country.
Oh, we chanted that.
No, and then at the end they go, sex.
Yes.
Just can't get enough. Sex!
Yeah. Now, that came later.
Did it?
I think so, yeah, because that became anthemic, I think, to our generation as a song for it. Like, it was a really great song to jump around to in disco, you know. Yeah. It was kind of like Where's Me Jumper for our generation. Yeah.
Great memories. Yeah. Were you paying attention to the world outside of, you know, where you lived, outside of Ireland? Were you paying attention to the news?
What a great question. Wow, that's a really I'm trying to think why. I mean, you're so introverted and thinking about yourself as a teenager. You're just trying to figure out everything. And funny, all my friends have teenage kids now, and I'm like, go easy. My dad was great. My dad used to say to my mum, go easy. It's a really hard time, and it is a really hard time. Was I looking at world affairs? I don't honestly know, but I do. There's a couple of things that stand out for me, but I think this isn't on the list. Is Lady Princess Diana's death that night? I remember really well because I was out clubbing. We came home at like 1:30 in the morning. We were real mad, and you know, it was on the Sky. And I remember people around me sort of getting really upset. And I remember being really shocked. I was like, "You didn't know her." I remember thinking, "Why are you upset?" But so that kind of ridiculous sentimentality about something that doesn't really affect you always really irritates me, and I still stand by that. Yeah.
All right.
Why are you crying? You didn't know her.
But you were pulled into it though.
I was shocked by the whole thing, and it was kind of a moment.
But talk to me a little bit about that, because that's interesting. This sort of communal grief.
Oh, God, can't be doing with it.
No.
It's stupid. You're crying about something that's going on in your own life. You're not. If you're crying about somebody that you don't know, a public figure that's died, unless their music melts something to you or, you know, I know a friend of mine who, you know, who devastated when George Michael died because he got him through his teenage years. And I understand that as much. But Lady Diana dying and there's teenage girls in my house crying. I'm like, what are you crying? You know,
So
that was interesting in that I kind of was like, I don't get that ridiculous public outcry for somebody you didn't know.
Right. You did say that this news story.
Go on, what was it?
It's 1989. So you were what, 18?
Yeah.
18.
There have been jubilant and emotional scenes as thousands of East Germans crossed the Berlin Wall into West Berlin last night after the lifting of travel restrictions by the East German government yesterday. It's the first time since the wall was built in 1961 that East Germans have been allowed to cross freely. From Berlin, this report by Maggie O'Kane.
It took some hours before the East Berliners took their government at its word and began flooding through the 9 gates that link the east and west of the city. They were greeted in the west by thousands of well-wishers who gathered to welcome them with champagne and flowers. Dumar ist weg, the wall is gone, was the chant in the streets around the wall tonight as thousands stepped into the west for the first time in their lives.
The first time in their lives.
I was in Brussels. I was a stagiaire in Brussels working in the European Commission, first work experience, interning, and we had heard it was coming down. It was really exciting, actually. And we were like, you could get these buses in Europe. I can't remember what they were called, Eurobus, and it was like a fiver or something. You could go like, through the night to Berlin from Brussels. And I remember it was one of my biggest regrets I didn't, because about 10 of them did go and were there for it. And it was so exciting, because actually, that is a news story that affected our generation. That was the changing of politics in Europe, and we were young adults, and I was working in the European Commission, and the wall came down. I mean, that was there for all of our childhoods. That Cold War, the experience of people behind that wall was always fascinating to us as children. We had this idea of kids in rags and no lights, and then on the other side of the wall, people partying and drinking beer. You know, so we had this image. So when that wall came down, that gripped me, and I was in Europe, in Central Europe. Mm. I should have gone that night. That's one of my regrets.
So you were an intern in Brussels?
Yeah. Imagine that.
Never knew that.
But I studied business, you see. I studied accountancy and economics. And there was a thing, it was actually really cute. I shouldn't say that. By the Department of Education. And it was called Team 1992. And it was ahead of the full open European market in 1992. They were taking business students from the north and south of Ireland to the European Commission to work in a business capacity under business leaders. Right. And the idea was to unite north and south business students before we all get sucked into Europe. And I remember the sort of naive vision was that actually there'll be no borders once Europe happens. So that'll be grand. The problem will go away. And that was unsaid.
Yeah,
that's
kind of
what the idea was, I think. And so we all went, I had the best 3 months of my life.
And was the sort of broadcasting and the fashion designer, was that bubbling under? Or was there any, was that
so
making that, it
all
itself
along
known
that
to
time,
you?
So my English teacher in Moyle Park, lovely man who said, you're a show off, Courtney, shut up. Here's a phone number. Go to this place. It's called the Dublin Youth Theatre. It's on Gardner Street. And I was about, just before my 15th birthday. And I went, so I was 14, I went to the Dublin Youth Theatre and I auditioned and I got in. And I was in the Dublin Youth Theatre from 14 to 19. And it was every Saturday and we put on shows at Christmas and it was just amazing. So I had this little outlet for performance.
And why didn't you stick with the acting?
I didn't stick with the acting because I felt I probably wasn't very good, to be honest, but I probably was. But the thoughts of pretending to be somebody else again just cut me in two. It took so long for me to be me and be happy with who I was. I was like, I don't want to act somebody else. I said, I'll just be a presenter because then I just have to be me all the time.
So you were acting somebody else in a heterosexual relationship?
I think so,
I think so.
And I think instinctively...
That's tough, isn't it?
Oh, it's a pain. I mean, it's just so... Living a lie is just... So hard. That's why I'm always amazed at people I know even who have extramarital affairs. I'm like, where'd you get the energy? Like, why would you bother?
Yeah.
What? So you take so much energy to lie. So when when society makes you lie and you see, they go, just don't lie. So the beautiful thing about coming through that is self-realization and going, I'm just never going to lie again. Lies. So the thoughts of acting, of learning a script to be someone else wasn't an art form that appealed to me. Being myself appealed to me. And at the time, people like Davina were doing Street Mate, and she was the first generation of our crew, older, a little bit older than us, who was being herself on screen. And I just was really attracted to that idea of people seeing you for yourself.
And you did Wanderlust.
Yeah.
Which was based strike a little chord bit on, for a lot of people.
It was based
listening.
A little bit on Street Mate as well, based on Davina, believe it or not.
And you wrote it, devised it,
yes.
Presented it.
Yeah, the whole
shebang.
I'd come from theatre, right? And television would, believe it or not, theatre people looked down their nose a little bit of television, in my experience. Oh, anecdotally, in my experience. And so I'd come from theatre. So I was like, how will I justify this to my friends that I want to be in? So I said, I want to write the show, conceive the idea, produce and present it. So it'll be my idea, my package. So that was kind of in my head. Also, if I'm really honest, at the time, I just wanted to be on telly.
It worked for you.
Call it what you will.
Now, we're running out of time and I want to talk to you about your dad, and there's text here. Somebody says, wonderful to hear Brendan on the radio. Loved his documentary on his dad. He comes across as a very decent guy and someone you could have a great laugh with. One of life's good guys, says Julie. Brendan was fantastic dealing with his dad's illness. That's really struck a chord, didn't it?
Didn't it? Yeah. I mean, people say to me now all the time, how's your mum? Like, she's looking for a roommate. Would you want one?
How long ago was it? Is it 3 years ago?
It'll be 3 years ago in June.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how are you?
I'm great. You know what? My dad was amazing in that he did some wonderful things towards the end. He said, the day before he died, he sort of said, touched my face, and we were calling him John Wayne in the hospice because of the documentary, and he's like kind of slightly enjoying his writing. And he said to me, which is kind of really interesting, I'm not crying, I have a cry. He said, do you think I'm afraid? And I was like, well, I don't know, are you? And he said, no, I'm not a bit afraid, so don't you worry about me. And that was like, okay. So at his funeral, I held his hand the whole time at the, you know, thing, and I wasn't nervous around his body. He kind of gave us permission to move on. It was amazing.
So reassuring that he said
just
that to you.
So beautiful. What a gift. Like, and what a great legacy for our memory of him, you know. It's just such, he said, don't be worrying. Yeah. Time now, and it was gorgeous. And because, you know, I'd had a real shock just 2 months before that. My best friend had died of an aneurysm. So he was 47. So that was a big shock. My dad, I told my dad, I waited for 4 weeks. And it was a big shock. And I said, Dad, you won't believe it. You won't believe who's dead. And he said, you know what, I will. People who haven't died before die every day. He was just amazing. He was amazing, yeah, yeah. It's so easy to love the dead. They make so few mistakes, right?
Yeah, it's all good, isn't it? It's all good. Cold milk only, come on, says somebody. And I remember...
Cold milk in the summer.
I remember Macushla, romantic or what...
See, people really remember the Macushla.
Yeah. And can you ask them for some fashion tips, please? What's in?
No.
No, okay.
Go to Dunn's, buy yourself a dress. That's what's in.
No, you have to go. But you're on the telly. You're back on the telly in a few weeks' time.
Yeah.
Sunday nights.
Sunday nights, 8:30, RTE1. I'll probably get loads of trouble for telling this, but I love you, Ray, so I'm going to tell you. Keys to My Life. It's a format we wrote a couple of years ago, and it's gorgeous. So we take, no doubt we'll be asking you to do it. Yeah. We take national treasures back to the homes they lived with and with some prizes along the way. So it's kind of like this is your life through the keyhole. And
very good.
It's like a long warm bath. It's
gorgeous. And it's a half hour.
It's beautiful.
Lovely length.
I think Anne Doyle is the first.
Anne Doyle.
I'm not allowed to say that.
You're not allowed to say that. You whispered it. Nobody heard you. Nobody heard you. Listen, it's been a real pleasure being in your company for the last half hour as you guided us through the soundtrack to your life. Brendan Courtney, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
That's a handshake. Probably shouldn't do that either.